Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for June 18th, 2017. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining us always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, well, tonight we're excited. Last Tuesday was the Virginia primaries, setting up the general election, one of the bigger general elections of 2017. And Lowell Feld's going to be our guest here in about 20 minutes to tell us all about it. I mean, if no one knows and follows Virginia politics more and better than Lowell Feld. So we're going to get the real inside information on that. We hadn't even discussed it because we were going to wait to have Lowell on, essentially, so we'd have the expert. But until then, we're going to talk about some national topics of the day. Then later in the show, we are going to give some predictions on Georgia 6 and the South Carolina, I believe it's 4 special elections after a while. But let's get right into it. Very, very sad situation. Middle of the week, there was yet another public shooting. Of course, there's shootings in America every day. I believe I read that on an average day, 9 people in America died due to gun violence. Fortunately, no one died. In the congressional baseball game practice, missing this, you know, deranged person, for lack of a better term, he called out, wanted to know which party's baseball team practice it was, and from there he opened fire. I know he hit one representative in the hip, Steve Scalise of Louisiana, and that was a pretty critical situation. Steve Scalise had surgery. They had to apply a lot of pressure on the blood flow just to keep him alive, but it looks like he's going to survive and be able to carry on, which is certainly a good thing. While we may want people to lose at the ballot box, we certainly don't want anyone to lose their life in that kind of manner, even if they don't agree with us in politics. Catherine, when you read these reports or saw these reports, usually it was more news bulletins or something across the internet in the morning, what did you think?
Well, you know, it's heartbreaking to think that, I mean, there's so much heartbreak in it. It's heartbreaking for the, you know, people who were shot and for their families and for the mood and tension that it creates for everyone who lives in that neighborhood and for anyone who's participating in the baseball game. So there's a lot of heartbreak. There's a lot of heartbreak on the side of the shooter. Like, what is it that prompted someone to do that? You know, you just, I can't help but think about that as well. And then it's important to remember that not much later in the day than that, there was another mass shooting in California at a UPS facility, and I think 3 people were killed there. So it's just, there's just a lot of heartbreak around guns in this country, and I just don't know what the answer is. And it makes me think a lot about guns and about how we respond to things in this country and how we seem to, many people seem to go for the gun first. And it's just, like I said, it's just heartbreaking.
Yes. Catherine, be careful not to politicize this. I heard somebody, actually someone's been on the show, a politician that posted that right after. Don't be afraid, you know, don't politicize this. And I saw the stat of 9 people every day, and you're like, well, if you, what day do you pick if you pick a day without a shooting, since on average it's multiple a day? Tim, what were your thoughts on there?
Well, first of all, what exactly is that 9 a day? That's much, much, much higher than that. I mean,
yeah,
I think that's Average deaths. Average deaths.
Well, 32,000 a year are killed with guns, and two-thirds of them, of course, are suicides, but it would be more like 90 a day, I guess, if you wanted to get to 32,000 in a year. Maybe nine
is staggeringly bad. Nine might be
homicides a day or something.
Homicides. Yeah. No matter what, it's still too high.
It's sad. It's just a continuation of a trend, especially the last 25 years or so, of a combination of mentally unstable people and guns, and they do bad things with them when they get their hands on them, and it's really a sad situation, and it seems to be something that no one's willing to take any action on, and I don't know an answer. I'm except to express surprise that maybe this hasn't happened even more. It's not about politics or parties or any of that. The last congressman that was shot before this was, you know, was a Democrat. These were Republicans. The gun don't care, and I imagine the shooter doesn't. So it's they don't seem to be willing to try to find answers, and I'm just afraid we're going to see more and more of this sort of thing. But it's really sad.
I don't think much will get done.
It's a funny thing that the only reason this shooting was not worse than it was that the congressman who got shot happened to be there. Scalise, as a member of the leadership, he had, you know, Capitol Hill police with him, and they're the ones that prevented this shooting from being probably four or five times more tragic than it was. We might have been talking today about 15 to 20 fatalities, God forbid, had those men not been there to put themselves on the line. And, you know, we just need to pray for the health of all of those who were wounded in the attack, and see what we can do about changing it, if anybody's willing.
Yes, I think it's going to be another one of these events, and then people are, you know, it seems like, you know, maybe, the Republicans will be, well, more guns could have prevented it. And then when you have the third baseman, it's called the hot corner in baseball. Does that mean that's the guy that carries the pistol? You know, I mean, it's just disheartening that people don't want to have a conversation because they have this sacred idol, in a way, a gun that they don't want to talk about in different ways. I mean, not all guns are created equal, and you ought to look at them differently. Speaking of that, you know, there were some good things. Oh, go ahead, Tim.
Just one more point that you just hit on. If they are wanting to talk about gun violence and guns are not part of the conversation, then I don't see any reason to talk about it at all. Do y'all?
Yeah, exactly.
It won't be a productive conversation. Yeah, I mean,
right.
And I will say this, after the event happened, I happened to be somewhere where they had a TV on, a fast food restaurant, and they had Paul Ryan speak. Didn't hear what he said, but then right after, Nancy Pelosi spoke. And from what I heard later, it was, you know, very come together type of speech. They had, you know, members of both parties speaking, condemning what happened, praying for those that were injured, and praising the Capitol Police. And then the next day, the game was played. The Democrats won. And they gave the trophy to the Republicans. Some great, I mean, beyond sportsmanship, bipartisanship, some really positive themes came out of it in the Capitol that day. But then I know that I believe Newt Gingrich later on in the day talked about how it seemed like liberals were getting angrier because apparently there are some ties to the shooter and some liberal slash progressive slash Democratic causes. Obviously, he's very misguided. And then reported today, Caitlyn Jenner spoke at some type of college Republicans event and talked about how, oh, well, liberals can't even shoot straight. What an unproductive comment. That was most unproductive. I mean, what is the of that? Can't even shoot straight. I couldn't believe that someone would make that, because if it's a joke, this isn't a laughing matter. And if you really think that's a important point, what are liberals supposed to do to prove, Bruce slash Caitlyn Jenner wrong? I was kind of thought that was completely tacky. And what I think so funny is I remember when she won the ESPN Courage Award, liberals got lambasted how this is all liberalism, that, it should have been this army individual that lost one of their limbs. And there was all this talk in the blogosphere and in social media about how, all these different things happened. It was all pro-liberalism, and yet the beneficiary of it now criticizes liberals' marksmanship. Catherine, you said you don't really want to respond to it. If you still don't, if not, I'll pass it to Tim.
I just want to say one thing. Her name is Caitlyn Jenner, not Bruce slash Caitlyn Jenner.
Well, I mean, people know
her name is Caitlyn,
the person for
David, for the
1976.
David, her name is Caitlyn Jenner. Her name is Caitlyn Jenner.
What does it say on the Wheaties box?
We're not going to get.
What does it
we're
say
not
on the
gonna
Wheaties
get
box?
In, I'm not going
to. I mean, a person has, if they have a history, that's like if you talked about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and you talked and said, oh, well, some people may know Lew Alcindor because, or Cassius Clay, because there was
okay,
a life
fine.
And history.
Whatever,
before.
David. You can disrespect her all you want, but it is disrespectful.
Well, whoever disrespected us, and by saying that can't shoot straight, and just totally heighten this horrible conversation. She doesn't deserve a lot of respect today in my book. That's just how I think. And I'm sorry I've gotten so upset, but I don't think that person deserves a lot of respect for such a distasteful comment. That's how I feel. This isn't about transgender issues. This is about how this person's behaving. So I mean, that's what I'm looking at it from. Tim?
I was going to say, first of all, yes, I can shoot straight. If anybody was wondering, I'm not a bad shot, just saying. Secondly, some of those folks that are making these off-the-wall comments like that might do well to remember there's a man laying in a hospital there in Washington. A congressman fighting for his life, and they ought to keep their eye on the ball. If they want to say anything productive, offer up prayers for the man's health, something like that.
That's all I know to say there. Poor time and place for any of those kind of comments. But let's move on to the Jeff Sessions testimony. He spoke before Congress. Different type of testimony than James Comey. I'll just kind of leave it off there. Catherine, when you saw the Jeff Sessions testimony, what were some of your thoughts?
Oh, I mean, so many. He's just like a sniveling little rodent to me. I have a hard time listening to him because, I know a lot of his history, and I just can't take him seriously, and I really sort of can't believe he's our attorney general, considering his background. But he just seemed to be on the defensive and very nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was very evasive. I mean, if you had to describe evasive. I mean, it was. There was one phrase I think they said he went to umpteen times. I can't recall. I don't recall. Something to that effect.
Yeah.
Kim, what was your thoughts on it? Oh, go ahead, Kevin.
Well, it was reminiscent of, who was it, Oliver North? Who kept saying, I don't recall. Was it Oliver North? It was reminiscent of one of the Iran-Contra testimonies. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Tim.
Oh, that's fine. Actually, that was a very good point that you just made, too. He and one that segues right into what I was about to say. He talked a lot of legalese. I don't recall. Well, maybe. Well, I'm not sure. I don't know. He played the anger card to begin with to defend himself, of course. He went kind of all in on protecting himself when he denied collusion or knowing about any. He refused to answer any questions regarding any conversations he had with Donald Trump, whether they were just talking about something secret or talking about the flavor of ice cream that they like. It's like the man was trying to pretend he had never spoken to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And there was no legal way, you know, to prevent him from saying, of course he could have said something, but he didn't do that. He tried to close the door on those allegations about the meetings with Russians at the Mayflower Hotel, and it looked like he had done that. And then later on in the testimony, he seemed to contradict that. The one of the cutest exchanges was, again, with Senator Harris, who I like better and better every time I see her. She got under his skin so bad, he finally said, and I'm not able to be rushed this fast. It makes me nervous. He's kidding me, right? A man that's been in the U.S. Senate for 20 years, he's all this stuff in politics his whole life, an attorney to boot, and a first-term senator from California rapid-firing a few questions at him is making him nervous. Oh, geez. He went there meaning to protect Donald Trump and himself. This time I thought the Republicans were a little more defensive and protective of Trump than they were before with Comey. I don't know if they're hedging their bets for political reasons or what they're doing. But I don't see where Sessions got a whole lot done either way. Do you, David?
No, I think it was if you went in believing him, you probably had something you could,
right,
you know, tie to keep believing,
right,
him. And if you didn't believe,
right,
him, he certainly, I don't think, changed any mind. I'll tell you,
right,
I didn't see every word of the testimony. I happened to happen upon it, if you will. Forgot it was even on. And Roy Blunt, the senator whose name escapes me from Oklahoma, he reminded me of a Undertaker, funeral parlor director, and Tom Cotton, they were just up there to try to softball / ask questions that were just defenses of him. I do think Marco Rubio was a little bit tougher than the average Republican, good for him, and asking questions. So I saw that. Now, one thing I will say is, you have, in 2 weeks, you have one guy that goes up there and goes, well, I immediately went and I detailed in my notes and I wrote this and on this date this happened, and gave so many details, almost more details than anybody could want, and then referenced his material and sourced it and everything else in James Comey. And then you got this other guy, I can't remember, over and over. So even if you think, well, one guy has a much better memory or is much more judicious in his note-taking and documentation, or somebody just didn't mean straight up with us. So I thought the juxtaposing of the two testimonies were gave Sessions the most problems. Catherine, did you notice the two sides of the coin, if you will?
I did notice the two sides of the coin, but I think the other thing that was so ridiculous was when he claimed he couldn't, it was against the rules of the Department of Justice for him to discuss his conversations with the president in because at some point in the future, he might claim executive privilege. So I heard a representative later who was on the ethics committee or something who said, well, if they could do that, then there would be no point in having any kind of ethics investigations
yep.
of the president because they would never have to say anything. So that mm-hmm. was totally – there's no precedent for that. There's no – I mean, that was totally made up. I mean, he was just – I mean, I think he's just spent his whole life being in a very privileged position where he doesn't have to answer any of these kind of questions. And now he's being, you know, he's under the hot lights now and he just doesn't know how to respond. Doesn't know how to behave, I should say.
Yes. Yes. Well, we got somebody, if you put the spotlight on him, he does know how to respond, especially when it comes to Virginia politics. Welcome our guest. For the umpteenth time, I guess I've used that word twice in this show, Mr. Lowell Fell. Welcome, Lowell.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, good to have you back. It seemed like a very appropriate time with the Virginia elections just – the primary elections just happening on Tuesday. Let's kind of set those up. I'll ask the first question, then I'll pass it to Tim and Catherine. We'll keep going. First question, the Republican side, this thing was supposed to be Ed Gillespie wins big, no big deal. He had a challenger that made it roughly a 2-point race, memory serves me. How did this race, which was supposed to be an anointing, get so close?
Yeah, it's really amazing. The polls, I thought the polls maybe were starting to get a little bit better, but I guess not, because in this case, the polls were off. The Washington Post had Gillespie up 20 points, and Gillespie only won by 43.7 to 42.5, so 1.2 points. So not exactly close there. What happened, I think, one thing is Republican turnout was very low. Democratic turnout was way higher, like 540,000 to 360,000. So I think that it's possible that because the Republican turnout was so low, the people who turned out were like the core Trumpsters, or what are you going to call them? You know, the really – the people who are the real Trump fans. And Corey Stewart, who was, you know, this challenger to Ed Gillespie, he ran on a platform of – he actually said this. He was Trump before Trump. Like, he was the original Donald Trump, basically. And Corey Stewart, by the way, was the – Virginia chair of the Trump for President campaign and was fired for, I mean, and this is hard to believe, for incompetence, I mean, in that campaign, but okay. But that's how bad Corey Stewart was. He was fired also for disobeying, I guess, a direct order from the Trump campaign. But anyway, so this guy appealed to Trump supporters. He ran on a basically a neo-Confederate platform. A lot of what he talked about was this supposed desecration of Confederate history, and that we shouldn't be tearing down these statues and monuments. And so he ran on that very, you know, pretty much hardcore on guns and abortion and all the whole nine yards in terms of the right wing, you know, platform. So I think, you know, in terms of who showed up for that Republican primary, I think it was the people who are the real hardcore right-wingers. They showed up. And Ed Gillespie is not an exciting guy. I mean, he's a longtime lobbyist. His nickname is Enron Ed because he was involved with the Enron scandals years ago. And I don't think Republicans were excited for him. He had a huge amount more money than Corey Stewart, but Corey Stewart was out there. He put up, like, I feel like he put up four or five Facebook live videos every day. He was constantly on social media. He was constantly saying really crazy, provocative things and getting earned media. attention, because the media loves that stuff, you know. I mean, they're just like drawn, it's like catnip to them, you know, because it gets clicks. So I think it's a combination of all that. And I also think a lot of people assumed Gillespie was going to win big. So maybe Gillespie supporters just were like, I don't know, we don't really need to go vote. I mean, he's got this. It's possible. Hard to really know. I mean, I haven't seen any exit polling or anything. But yeah, that one ended up being – that was – I mean, I was live blogging the results as I usually do, and – I was expecting it to be a blowout, and it was like the results are coming in, and it's tied, or Corey Stewart was a little ahead. I'm like, okay, this has got to change. And then it didn't change. And I'm like, what is going on here? So that was pretty crazy.
Yeah, I guess Corey Stewart building a bridge to the 19th century.
Basically. Taking us back to, you know, the pre-Reconstruction era, pre-Civil Rights era, whatever you want to say. I mean, you know what's ironic about Corey Stewart, or just bizarre and ironic, but he is the chairman of the Prince William County Board of Supervisors. Now, if you don't know Prince William County, it's one of the largest counties in Virginia. It's in the D.C. metro area, and it is a majority-minority. In other words, the majority of the county is minority, either African American or Latino mostly, and Asian American too. But he's the chairman of the board there, and yet he's running on a neo-Confederate platform. It's crazy.
Yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Well, let me kind of still stop up but pivot here. Let's be expecting to win, but doesn't win. General election.
We're losing you, David.
Yeah, I can't really hear you too well. But
David, repeat all that.
I'm sorry. How does the Ed Gillespie win being so weak affect his general election prospects?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question. You know, right now, well, it's not just the fact that he barely won the primary. After the first of all, Corey Stewart on election night did not concede. In fact, at that point, it wasn't absolutely sure that Gillespie was gonna pull it out. But since then, Corey Stewart has grudgingly said, okay, I'm going to back the ticket. But you could tell he's not enthused. They haven't had a big unity event or anything like that. So I think it hurts. I definitely think it hurts Gillespie because and Corey Stewart basically laid down his demands that Gillespie, in order to win Corey Stewart's supporters, is going to have to absolutely support Trump, which right there is a big problem because because Gillespie really needs to distance himself to some extent from Trump. Corey Stewart also wants Gillespie to be very strong on these Confederate history and these monuments. Which that's not going to work either. So basically Corey Stewart's not doing what the Democrats have done on the Democratic side. Perriello has said he's going to do whatever it takes. He's going to stop at nothing to help elect Ralph Northam, the Democratic nominee. So we're totally unified on the Democratic side. And on the Republican side, it doesn't look that way, at least right now at all. So I think Gillespie comes out of this weakened, weak. I think right now, I mean, and, you know, I'm out of the prediction business since November 2016, forever.
We all are.
But as of right now, I would rather be in our shoes by far and away. Like, I think Democrats are definitely favored to win the governor's mansion again, hold it, win the lieutenant governor, attorney general, and pick up a bunch of seats in the House of Delegates. Assuming Trump's still in office and he's still unpopular and all that, and assuming that Democrats still have the type of energy that was shown on Tuesday night with the turnout we saw on the Democratic side, and Republicans are kind of not excited or whatever, as we saw Tuesday night. So, you know, if that's the way this is shaping up, and if the Republican Party continues to be divided, where Corey Stewart is only grudgingly supporting the ticket, then I think it bodes very well right now. Now, a lot can change between now and November. I mean, a few months, these days seems like an eternity. But we'll see. But it looks good right now.
Yes. Well, I'll go ahead and pass it on to Tim, then Catherine, for more questions about all these races that happened the other night.
Good evening, Mr. Feld. Again, welcome to the Kudzu Vine.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
You keep mentioning the 540,000, and as it turns out, that was a record turnout for a primary in a non-presidential year. Why are the Democrats so engaged this year in Virginia? Is it the Trump effect? Is it the addition of the progressive wing of the party getting engaged? What is it about this particular year that's driving such huge turnouts there?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, you're seeing it somewhat in the Ossoff race, too. But, I mean, one thing is Trump, of course. I mean, we saw it starting with the Women's March in, well, across the country. But in D.C., there were maybe a million people. I don't know. There are different estimates on how many people were there. But it's a huge – I was there. You couldn't move. It was absolutely packed. The entire National Mall was packed. So, you know, that type of energy, some of it's, I guess, gone away. But, I mean, a lot of it's still there. So that's part of it. And then you had what looked like it to be a sleepy affair where Ralph Northam, who's the lieutenant governor of Virginia, was just going to waltz into the Democratic nomination unchallenged. Then all of a sudden, on January 3rd, we read in the New York Times that Tom Perriello, former Congressman Tom Perriello, who had been a special envoy for Barack Obama in Africa and obviously didn't expect Hillary Clinton to lose, but when she did, he decided to run for governor as well. And so we had a primary, I would say exciting, somewhat heated. I mean, primaries get that way, but, you know, it was a lively, whatever, primary. And so that's part of it. I mean, the Democrats, people supported Perriello, people supported Northam, and people were very engaged in this primary. So combination of those two things, I'd say Trump and then having two candidates running hard against each other. A lot of money was spent, too, between those two candidates on TV advertising and social media advertising and everything. So, yeah, combination of all that, I think, explains the turnout. I mean, we've had primaries in the past, of course. In 2009 was the last time we had a Democratic governor's primary in Virginia. That was when Terry McAuliffe was in a primary against Cree Deeds and Brian Moran. And turnout then was 319,000, so still far lower. But remember, 2009, that was after Obama had won the presidency. And I feel like Democrats were going to sleep by that point. By June of 2009, it was like Republicans were starting to get revved up. The Tea Party was starting up a little, you know, about then. And by November of that year, the Tea Party was going full out. And but Democrats were sort of, you know, okay, we elected Obama, and so I guess everything's great now. So so they kind of weren't super motivated necessarily to come out and vote. This time they definitely were. Now, still, I mean, even with 500,000 votes, it's still only 17% turnout. I mean, it's still pathetic in a way. I mean, it should be 100% of people should vote, right? In my opinion,
right.
But anyway, still a lot better than historically.
And looking down ballot, because it seems that the top of the ticket looks pretty good for us right now, but in Virginia, and you know these figures, but for our listeners, I'll throw them back out there again. The Republicans in Virginia have 66 of the 100 seats in your House of Delegates and 7 of 11 House seats.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you consistently lately are winning statewide races. And we combine that with the fact that Eric Holder was your speaker at your JJ dinner.
Right.
Is gerrymandering going to be a big issue in this campaign?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been an issue. Tom Perriello brought it up many times. Ralph Northam's brought it up many times. But there's nothing we can do about it right now, though. I mean, I feel like to the extent gerrymandering as an issue can help motivate our voters to turn out, that's great. We can't do anything mm-hmm. about it till after the next census, at which point there'll be another, you know, redistricting. That's one of the reasons why it's so important that we win the governor's mansion again, hold it, because who, you know, that's that person's going to be in there after the next census. So that's important. But I think, you know, you got to keep in mind that we have about 17 or so districts, House of Delegates districts in Virginia right now that are held by Republicans, but that were won by Hillary Clinton mm-hmm. in November. So you add 34, which is what Democrats have right now in the House of Delegates. You add, let's just say we won all those 17. Not likely, but let's just say there was a huge wave and we won all the 17 that Hillary Clinton won, you know, in November and that are held by Republicans. We'd have 51. That's a majority. So, you know, I mean, and it's amazing, actually. Ralph Northam, Saturday night was our JJ dinner, the state JJ dinner, and Ralph Northam mentioned multiple times that we need to try to win back the House of Delegates this year, which would mm-hmm. be incredible to pick up 17 seats in one cycle. And before, you know, this year, nobody talked like that. It was like maybe if we could pick up two or three seats, and then we pick up two or three the next 2 years later, and then, you know, and now they're talking mm-hmm. like, because we're seeing, because if you look at the margin that we saw Tuesday night, 543,000 Democrats, 366,000 Republicans, if we have something like that, and we might not, but if we do, and let's say Democrats win for governor by 10 points or something like that, we could pick up a slew. I don't know how you define slew, or how I define slew, but it could be 8, 10, 12 maybe, you know, House of Delegates seats, I think. I mean, and we have a lot of good candidates, I think, a lot of women. One of the big stories in Virginia on Tuesday night was women didn't lose, I mean, basically, except in one case for lieutenant governor on the Democratic side, she lost to an African-American man. But other than that, women, when they ran, they won. A lot of times it was women running against women in these primaries for House of Delegates districts. So women couldn't lose because there were only women running in those. But where there was a woman running against a man, there was only one case where the man won. Every other, I think it was like 15 out of 16 or something like that, where women won. This may be, remember, this started with the Women's March. Right, the day after uh-huh. Donald Trump's inauguration, and it seems like, you know, there's been a year of the woman before, and this is shaping up. It seems like more and more like another one, big time.
Well, so, interestingly enough, I'm throwing it to a lady who would be very interested in hearing what more about this. Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, that is great news. That is really great news. I'm happy to hear that. And we have a lot of women who are newly engaged here in Georgia in the 6th District, as well as sort of around the state, who are, you know, stepping forward mm-hmm. when they never have before. But my concern is, and maybe you can comment on this, how do we keep all these people engaged? I mean, I think it helps that we have wins like we did in Virginia to see, I mean, wins in you know, high Democratic turnout. I think that always sort of boosts the people to say, oh, well, everybody else is voting, so I'm going to keep voting. You know, I think that helps. But I'm mm-hmm. concerned about keeping these people engaged to 2018, especially because I'm also very concerned about the census and about gerrymandering, about all this, about the gerrymandering and about the mm-hmm. just the whole dynamic of voting. And it's sort of like my constant thinking is on how do we keep these people engaged? I'm very optimistic about Tuesday here in Georgia, but I think it's going to be very close. And I'm concerned that all this excitement around John Ossoff, if he doesn't prevail, you know, what is it going to do to all those people who have been so excited about it. So what do you have any thoughts on that? Have you thought about it much?
I mean, I think, you know, part of it is Trump, of course. As long as he's in the White House and continues to be really unpopular, certainly amongst Democrats, he's wildly unpopular. I don't think you're going to have too much trouble keeping people motivated. We already have Democrats and a lot of women, a number of women lining up for next year already. Forget this year. We have, our governor's race this year, but we have for Congress next year, we already have women lining up and men to take on, to run for Congress next year. So I think, I don't think it looks like a problem. In fact, if anything, it looks like an embarrassment of riches right now. I think also, though, I mean, yeah, it would be nice if Democrats start winning some of these. Like Ossoff on Tuesday night would be a really good one to win. I mean, we've been coming close. We came close in a couple of special elections so far for Congress in the last few, month or two, but we haven't quite won. And I could see people getting frustrated if that continues. But, so it would be really nice to win one, like, hint, hint, Tuesday night. So I think part of it's Trump just being Trump, and part of it is Democrat. And then the other thing is, I mean, Democrats definitely have to stand for something. We can't just run as anti-Trump. That's clear. And I think Perriello talked a lot about that here, and Northam as well. I mean, they both have talked about that. Democrats need to fight for a $15 an hour minimum wage, and we need to fight for women's, reproductive freedom and just economic, an economy that works for everybody, for the working class and for everybody. And we need to give people a reason to vote for Democrats and to get excited about the prospect of Democrats. I mean, look what happened in France today. When people get excited about something, they can totally overturn a whole system that's been in place for years. I mean, you had Macron and his party just swept today. I don't know if we're building to that in the United States. We have a different system here. We don't have a parliamentary system, whatever. But, I think Democrats have to be the party of ideas. We have to be the party of reform and change and also resistance to Trump.
Well, I think all sounds great, and I am encouraged to hear. It's good to be reminded that Trump is going to continue to be there and continue to. I mean, I'm not happy about it, but he does.
Right.
He does inspire activism in ways that we haven't seen before. So
yeah,
I guess we have that. David. Thanks.
Right. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Sure.
Yes. Well, Lowell. Told you when we booked you, we wanted to talk to some congressional races, just kind of looking ahead early because we know this is the time you get into candidate recruitment. You don't have to go on every district. I mean, if there's just no, challenger or what have you, you can go past us quick. But I'm sure there's going to be a district or two that are going to be very important to 2018 control of Congress. I guess going number order with the first.
Yeah, the most important one, we've talked about this one, I think, several times before, is Virginia 10th, which is suburban D.C. It starts just a few miles west of D.C., and then it goes all the way to the West Virginia border. So it's a big, sprawling district, but it's a district Hillary Clinton won in November. But it's for Congress, it's right now the incumbent is a Republican, Barbara Comstock, and she is definitely one of the ones that Democrats will have to beat. If we have any chance of taking back the House, and I think we do next year, that's a key race. So, and we have right now at least four, and maybe more. I may be missing some, but three women and a man. They do still allow them in there, I guess. But anyway, running already have declared that they're going to run in that district. So that's shaping up. And then there's another swingy sort of district down in the Hampton Roads area in Southeast Virginia, where there's a Republican incumbent, Scott Taylor. And I've heard, no one's declared yet, but I've heard there are a couple of women, again, who are seriously, who are, I think, are going to run. They just haven't declared yet. So that's going to be an interesting one. Three candidates have declared in the first, which is a red district, but, you know, it's held by Representative Rob Whitman, who is a fairly right-wing – well, they're all fairly right-wing, but anyway, so guy. But, you know, so that's another one. There's the fifth, which is a possibly winnable district, especially in a wave type of year, and we already have a candidate there. Trying to think of some other ones. There are a few other districts where we don't have – oh, the seventh, Dave Bratt. That's a red district, but we already have three candidates, all women again, who I believe have all declared, actually. Those are actually the declared, and there may be more getting in there. So, you know, yeah, I mean, there's – and I'm sure recruitment's going on hot and heavy all over the country. So, yeah, there's a lot of interest in running already next year. I mean, usually we don't see this, like, in, you know, June of 2017 or the year before the midterms. This level, even in red districts, it's fascinating. So I think it bodes well. I mean, hopefully this is happening in Georgia, and hopefully this is happening across the country, not just here in Virginia.
Yes, it actually is. I think as a direct result of John Ossoff running, there's a gentleman, his name escapes me. He is the CEO and founder of one of the largest test prep companies, getting students ready to take SATs and ACTs and other tests. He's going to run a campaign, and he seems to be a very knowledgeable and the kind of candidate that's going to understand how to secure financing. Probably not to the level of John Ossoff. I'm not sure anybody's going to get that kind of funding in a congressional race with 400-some-odd of them, 335 of them. But, I mean, we're seeing that already. One more prediction before I pass it to see if Tim and Catherine have anything else. We know that there are some places that the Democrats are going to win the House back. You pretty much have to win a seat in Florida. You're going to have to win a seat in California. Probably one's going to have to flip in Texas. For the Democrats to win back the House, does at least one of these Virginia seats have to flip?
Yeah, I mentioned the 10th, definitely. It has to. That's
and
one
so
we
it,
have to win.
So it's kind of a bellwether.
Yeah, definitely. That's one Hillary Clinton won. And we have to win the ones Hillary Clinton won. I mean, there's just no doubt about that. I mean, if we don't win those, we're not winning back the House, you know, period. By the way, there's one other race next year. Tim Kaine is up for re-election next year. So, and apparently Corey Stewart, who we were talking about earlier, he's hinted that he might run among other like Laura Ingraham and Carly Fiorina. Remember her of the she ran for U.S. Senate in California with the infamous Demon Sheep ad. I don't know if you remember that thing with the sheep with the red eyes glowing in the dark. Whatever.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Crazy Carly Fiorina. So, and she also ran for president, you know, last year in the Republican primaries. But anyway, that's going to be crazy next year. Basically the freak show running to take on Tim Kaine. Gonna be fun to watch that. So.
Oh, Carly Fiorina. She not only ran for president, she ran for vice president. The only person
briefly,
I believe, to do so last cycle. First person I know to have run for vice president, getting the nomination, if you will, of Ted Cruz before they actually had the convention or a nominee, which I've never seen that somebody not be the nominee and put up a vice presidential candidate. I'm sure it's happened. I don't remember it in my lifetime from one of the two major parties. Well, Tim, Catherine, any more questions for Lowell about Virginia politics?
Well, I got to ask one more, Lowell, because you and I have discussed this before, but let's say the Democrats, as we are all hoping, do very well on election night in November in Virginia statewide. Considering other recent results, would we at long last be able to finally say that Virginia is no longer purple, but is now a blue state?
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice, huh? Since my blog is called Blue Virginia, that's kind of the goal. It's an aspirational.
Really.
It's been aspirational. It would be, and hopefully inspirational. It would be nice to be an actual thing. I mean, look, we control, Democrats control all the statewide offices in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
We're getting there for Congress, but for the House, but you know, those are tough gerrymandered districts, and the main challenge has been turnout for Democrats in off-year and midterm elections. There's definitely a big drop-off for Democrats in the non-presidential years. So, yeah, if Democrats turn out in proportionally to the presidential years, then Virginia should be a blue state, not by a huge margin, but still. I mean, Hillary won it by 5 points, and Obama won it by 6 and 4. So we should be winning. We should have a majority in the House of Representatives, and we should definitely be picking up at least a bunch of seats in the House of Delegates. So I think, yeah, we're getting there. You know, like
all
Rome
right.
wasn't built in
well,
a day, right? So
yeah, but I'm just saying. I just keep asking this because we in Georgia are looking to other southern states like
mm-hmm.
your state to provide us the roadmap of what we need to do here to finally get over the hump. Right, Catherine?
That's right. Oh, God, yes.
Oh, God, yes.
Well,
yeah, I know the feeling.
Right.
Well, good luck to you guys down there, and good luck to us up here, I guess, too.
Yeah.
Yes,
we're all
you've
in it together.
Got a long year of work to do with your general elections in November, and, of course, doesn't stop there like it won't for any of us in even years. Well, Lowell, we thank
right.
you for coming on the Kudzu Vine.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me, and, good luck Tuesday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And that's Lowell Feld. He is the blogmaster at bluevirginia.us. I know he said it, but I'll give that full title there. Also, he is a very, very good read on Twitter. If you search Lowell Feld, I can't imagine his Twitter handle wouldn't pop up for you, so you could begin to follow him. Well, we just have a few minutes. Now, Catherine, you said you're out of the prediction game, but I hope you have at least something when we get into the Georgia 6 and then the South Carolina. Let's go ahead and do the South Carolina first. Let's get the hard one out of the way, because this is a low-information prediction, if you will, because I can't find a poll. I don't know how many ads the candidates have gotten to run. My gut feeling is this won't get the turnout of Georgia 6, and therefore if one party has extraordinarily high turnout, that could change the complexion. I'll go ahead and be brave, and I'll make the prediction first on this hard one. And I think that while Archie Purnell may not win, this may look a lot like the Kansas district, where the Democrats came within 5 points in a district that they were supposed to be nowhere close. I think it could be even closer than five. It could be one of those two-point elections. Even if we don't win it, it's going to shock people. It's because not everybody voted, but more Democrats voted because South Carolina Democrats were angry and more motivated than their Republican counterparts, and they won't need as much knowledge of the election as they're getting in Georgia 6. Catherine, any ideas on the South Carolina one?
Yeah, you know, like you, I haven't seen any polls, and it hasn't been, there hasn't been nearly as much publicity as we've gotten around here. But I'm going to say the Republican wins, but I think it'll be tight, and it'll be a late night.
Okay, and then Tim, South Carolina election.
Yeah, Norman, unlike in a lot of other districts, this guy has been running hard right toward Donald Trump. He figures that's a safe thing to do in that district, and I'm going to say at least this go-around is right. He wins by between 5 and 10 points.
Okay. Well, we'll see. If it's more, 5 or more, Tim was right. If it's less than 5, Catherine and myself are right. If Archie Parnell wins, I think we'll all be pleasantly surprised, even though none of us were willing to go out on that limb. Well, let's talk about the one that we've been following for, good gracious, did it start like the day after the election? It's been months now. Georgia 6. Kudos to David Neer. I saw this thing getting covered on the, I believe it was the ABC National News, and David Neer spotted this thing literally as soon as Price got tapped back in January that this could be a flip. And even if it doesn't flip, David Neer called this one as far as being a competitive election. So I just wanted to give him some credit. Catherine, you live closer to this district than Tim and I. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, there's a lot of enthusiasm around John Ossoff, as everybody knows. He had a couple of rallies yesterday. The president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, Cecile Richards, was in town, and she attended a couple of rallies and other events, and there was a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of people. And he was there with Congressman Lewis. It was Congressman Lewis, Cecile Richards, and John Ossoff at one of the rallies. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of positive enthusiasm around John Ossoff, and not as much around Karen Handel. But, you know, people coming out to rallies doesn't mean they vote, you know, doesn't mean votes, doesn't mean that all those people that are all excited are voters. So that makes clear. But I am optimistic about this race. But, you know, it's a very – it's dicey. Tom Price won it, you know, very strongly in November, even though Donald Trump did not. But I think it's going to be a late night. Whatever happens, it's going to be very close. I'm optimistic that John Ossoff wins, but I'm not, you know, I'm not 100% sure about that.
Okay, Tim, your thoughts?
Well, according to reports I'm seeing, about 140,000 early votes have been cast, including 36,000, by the way, who did not vote in the first round of voting. This thing's a very unique. It's, of course, a special election. That makes it unique. The amount of money thrown into it, most in U.S. history, unprecedented, and the type of district, as Catherine just alluded to it. It's going to be tough to swallow, though, if Democrats don't win this one. This is the kind of district we got to win if we're going to win, you know, big in the midterms next year, not to mention what we might or might not do statewide here. These are not Donald Trump Republicans, largely. We're talking about these are more of your traditional GOP folks. All that being said, got to pick somebody. I'm going to pick Handel by two.
All right. So that's going against the polls we've seen, which I think we talked about this before the show. The polls are just, you know, you have to predict the sample.
You don't know
all what it's about.
Wrong I hope I am.
Yeah, I think that just the enthusiasm is all on John Ossoff's side. I think had what happened in the past, say, 3 weeks nationally would have happened in the 3 weeks preceding the first round, he'd had 50+1. All of the national news trends are just against Karen Handel. I know Karen Handel, Mike Hassinger, he's been on several news programs, and they try to make this about Karen Handel in a Georgia race, but it's so nationalized. And I think John Ossoff's not only going to win, I think he's going to win by 5 or more points. I think that 7-point poll is more in line, I think. And I think the enthusiasm's going to come in. Karen Handel's just not liked a lot by Georgia voters. Now, I think that stems from some long-term dislike of female candidates by Georgians that Georgians going to have to look at. But this is just not the race, because this race is about Donald Trump and the national political scene, right or wrong for Ossoff or Handel, and that's what's going to carry Ossoff to victory. And but then he's going to have to put his defense on, because he's going to have to start running that district in even and regular years. He's not going to get millions of donations.
But,
so
look,
I think this
right,
one might be
point.
The easiest election he has.
Let me and Catherine get you on the record now again. You were saying not only is he going to win, but he's going to win fairly easily. Is that what you're telling us?
Five or more points. No, I'm saying if he wins by five, I'm going to take. If he wins by four, it sounds like Catherine's going to be right. So basically, we got a good one here. If Handel wins, Tim's right. If he wins by one vote to 4.9%, Catherine's right. If it's 5% or more, I'm right. So we got a good one there. It's pretty clear cut. So we'll see. I mean, that enthusiasm, you think it's got to go somewhere. And Karen Handel hasn't broken away from the national trend in any way. If she had come out and criticized Donald Trump or done something to make her look definably different than what Donald Trump's doing, then, you know, it might be a different story. But while she's not running to Donald Trump, she's certainly not running away from him. Given the NRA appearance, I think you could make the case that she is running somewhat to him. And so we shall see. Well, been interesting, Kudzu Vine. Next week we can recap these two special elections, and who knows who will have testified by then.
Really?
What else come up? I don't even think we got to Robert Mueller's newest news. There'll be more to talk about. So until then, been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night.
Good night, guys.
Not everybody.